The headlines, the U.S. Capitol goes under heavy security days ahead of the presidential inauguration after a deadly attack on Congress by Trump supporters. Turkey says that it will be very problematic for Ankara to turn back on its purchase of Russian S-400 defense systems. And also on our headlines, South Korea's top court upholds a 20-year jail term for former President Park Geun-hye on graft charges that led to her downfall. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, authorities in the U.S. are beefing up security in the capital, Washington, D.C., ahead of the January 20th inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. More than 20,000 National Guard troops will remain on high alert in the city. The Pentagon earlier announced that these forces are also authorized to carry weapons and make arrests, citing public safety as their priority. A number of public areas and monuments will also be closed to the public until after the inauguration. The security measures come amid fears of violent protests during that ceremony. Last week, the Congress building was breached by supporters of President Donald Trump, and five people were killed as a result. The House of Representatives has already impeached Trump over charges of inciting insurrection on the Capitol. The U.S. House of Representatives has voted to impeach President Donald Trump for the second time, making him the only U.S. president to be impeached twice.
On this vote, the ayes are 232, the nays are 197. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
10 Republicans also voted for the motion. Trump was impeached over the charge of incitement of insurrection for his role in last week's deadly Capitol protests. The impeachment triggers a Senate trial just 1 week before Trump leaves office. Following the vote, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said there's no chance a fair and serious impeachment trial of Trump could conclude before President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in on January the 20th. Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer said if Trump is convicted at Senate impeachment trial, there will be a vote on barring him from running again for presidency. At a ceremony signing the article of impeachment, Nancy Pelosi once again slammed Trump.
Today, in a bipartisan way, the House demonstrated that no one is above the law, not even the President of the United States. That Donald Trump is a clear and present danger to our country, and that once again, we honor that oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States.
In his first comments after being impeached, Trump did not mention the House vote at all. In a videotaped, the U.S. president urged Americans to be united and avoid violence. Trump said those who engaged in the attacks last week on the Capitol will be brought to justice. Similarly, in a statement, President-elect Biden did not take a stance on how the Senate should try Trump. He, however, urged the upper chamber to address the priorities of his agenda, even as it deals with the impeachment. Political commentator Ramiro Funes says President Donald Trump's second impeachment will have serious implications for him, his party, and the U.S. itself.
The fact that Donald Trump is the first U.S. president to be impeached twice has some serious implications, not only for Trump himself, not only for the Republican Party, but for the United States as a whole. We've seen a lot of firsts throughout this presidential administration. This is one of the most divided times in the United States. Politically, polarization is at an all-time high. Political instability is becoming the norm in the United States, as well as government shutdowns. In 2020, we were very close to getting to a government shutdown. Tensions in the United States are going to continue getting worse as long as the crisis continues getting worse. People also have to remember that we're dealing with multiple crises at the same time. COVID-19 is destroying major cities in the United States, including Los Angeles, where I am now, New York, Washington, D.C. People are losing their jobs, businesses are shutting down. The economic, political, and financial crisis that is hitting the United States is something that Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and the Democrats are not prepared at all to handle.
Author and journalist Daniel Azar says the second impeachment of Donald Trump shows the United States is experiencing a deepening structural crisis.
The U.S. is entering into a period of growing instability for a variety of reasons. COVID-19 is out of control. Nearly 400,000 people have died. The American empire is in crisis. It's grossly overextended. 22 million jobs have disappeared since the lockdown. A massive housing crisis is looming. And now the political system itself, a 233-year-old political system, which has never been thoroughly revised, is now collapsing before our very eyes. And that's what this is about. This is about a deepening structural crisis where the two branches are at each other's throat. The parties are far apart. There's no opportunities for resolution. Things can only get worse and worse.
The Turkish defense minister says Ankara will not turn back on its deal for Russian S-400 missile systems, despite opposition from the U.S. Hulusi Akar said annulling the contract on the S-400 import would be, quote, very problematic. However, he expressed hope that a dispute with the U.S. on the issue could be resolved through dialogue. He called on Washington to distance itself from threatening language such as sanctions. Washington slapped sanctions on Turkey last month following its acquisition of S-400s. The U.S. says the Russian missile systems pose a threat to its F-35 fighter jets and to NATO's broader defense systems. Turkey rejects the accusations and says S-400 will not be integrated into NATO. South Korea's apex court has upheld a 20-year prison term for former President Park Geun-hye over a corruption conviction. The ruling is final on an extended legal process, including a previous Supreme Court hearing. The court also upheld fines and forfeits totaling $19.5 million. Park Geun-hye was impeached in 2017 following massive protests against her. The following year, she was convicted of bribery and abuse of power and sentenced to 30 years in prison. Her sentence was later reduced to 20 years following her appeals and a retrial. The country's first female president has also separately been sentenced to 2 years in prison for election law violations. She now faces a total of 22 years behind bars. Jennifer Chang says Park Geun-hye's hardline policy on North Korea was one of the main reasons why South Koreans opposed her during her presidency.
Well, of course, the majority of South Koreans still oppose pardoning President Park. They still haven't forgiven her for all of her crimes, which ultimately led to her becoming the only South Korean president ever to be removed from office through the impeachment process back in 2017. Much of that had to do with not only her crimes, but also her hardline North Korea policy, which many South Koreans felt was going to bring on a possible second Korean War, which to South Koreans is unacceptable. President Park, when she was president, she was willing to actually conduct a preemptive strike militarily on North Korea if it was thought that the North would attack the South. So she had a variety of reasons why the South Korean public opposes her.
A team of international scientists led by the World Health Organization has arrived in the Chinese city of Wuhan to begin a probe into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. Peter Ben Emberek, leader of the team, said they would initially focus on advancing several studies and site visits. He, however, added that the investigation would take a long time. The arrival of WHO experts coincides with China's announcement of its first COVID-related fatality in 8 months. The country has also recorded its highest daily cases in more than 5 months. China is grappling with the resurgence of the coronavirus amid strict lockdowns. A total of nearly 88,000 infections and over 4,600 related deaths have been reported there since the emergence of the virus in late 2019. Stephen Rabay says the WHO investigation into COVID-19 origins in China will be highly politicized.
The U.S. under Trump, for example, has blamed China for not being transparent enough at the beginning of this pandemic and not doing enough to warn the rest of the world, which is a bit rich coming from Trump, who downplayed the threat right at the beginning. Of course, it's disappointing. This mission has been a long time coming. It was held up by China, and the WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has said he actually criticized China. He said he was disappointed that they weren't given clearance to arrive earlier. I think it's because China's scared of this blame game, that the whole thing is going to be used as an exercise to blame China. It must be stressed that blame is going to do no good whatsoever. Everybody is hoping that the WHO scientists will be able to interview, be able to research, and find out where this virus came from in order to save the world from a future epidemic. Maybe something which is much worse than this one.
Moving on, Ugandans are heading to the polls to cast their ballots in national elections amid heavy military and police presence in the capital, Kampala. The ballot pits incumbent President Yoweri Museveni against singer-turned-lawmaker Bobi Wine, who's half his age. Museveni is seeking a sixth term in office. He's ruled the country for almost four decades and is accused of crushing any opposition. The internet went down on the eve of the vote, with some parts of the country reporting complete disruptions or significant slowdowns. After one of the most violent campaigns in years, the run-up to the polling day was marred by a sustained crackdown on Museveni's rivals and government critics. Some 18 million voters are registered for the presidential and parliamentary vote, and results are expected by Saturday. The Iranian Navy is holding the second and final day of massive military exercises in the Sea of Oman. Iranian surface combat units, subsurface naval forces, as well as aerial units are practicing battles with mock enemy forces and are performing joint operations against any possible military scenario. Surface-to-surface cruise missiles and torpedoes will be fired from domestically developed submarines during the exercises. Unmanned aerial operations and electronic warfare tactics will be exercised as well. The drills are aimed at boosting the preparedness and military prowess of the country's armed forces in the strategic southern waters.
Iran's navy has unveiled the country's largest military vessel, called Makran. It is a mobile base that can carry choppers and support the military frigates of the Iranian army's navy. This 228-meter auxiliary ship was in fact a trade ship, but the army changed it basically to turn into a floating port capable of carrying up to 82,000 tons of warships' needs. The support ship can also carry five helicopters and a battalion. It can travel for 1,000 days without having access to ports. Zereh was the other vessel unveiled by the Navy in the presence of top commanders.
The Iranian frigate, called Zereh or Armor, is an extremely useful vessel. It is very fast and powerful and can carry out its missions very well. It is equipped with advanced radars and electronic warfare facilities. Zereh can play a great role in safeguarding Iran's national interests. As the frigate is a totally indigenous one, it shows that our experts have successfully bypassed the sanctions.
Zereh is a missile-launching frigate of 47 meters length that can move at a speed of 35 nautical miles. It can launch cruise missiles up to 300 kilometers. After joining these two vessels, some sudden drills called Marine Power 99 were staged to check the readiness of the forces.
These drills were not on our agenda. The goal was to check the preparedness and quick reaction of our facilities and forces. vessels, submarines, drones, coast-to-sea missiles were tested during this exercise, and they entered the Mach danger zone extending over 600,000 kilometers.
The surface-to-surface cruise missiles, submarine, and flight units of the Iranian Navy took part in the drills. With these two vessels joining the Iranian Navy, the country's waters are safer than before, and a clear message is sent to Iran's enemies that they should never think of waging a war against the country. Human Abedi, Konarak.
Iran has warned that the U.S. designation of Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a terrorist organization will hamper peace efforts in the country. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the blacklisting will also undermine the delivery of humanitarian aid to Yemen. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the outgoing Donald Trump administration is seeking to finish off its destructive role in Yemen's war and bring a political solution and peace talks in the Arab country to a deadlock. He pointed to the U.S. financial and military support for the Saudi-led coalition, saying Washington is the main accomplice to the crimes in Yemen. The U.N. has also warned about the serious humanitarian and political repercussions of blacklisting. The move will come into effect on January the 19th, the Trump administration's last full day in office. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has left its biggest toll on the children. The number of malnourished children in the Yemeni province of Hodeidah continues to grow amid the absence of international assistance in saving the children in the war-torn country. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
The Saudi atrocities against Yemeni children are endless. Hodeidah is one of the worst affected areas in Yemen. The children there suffer from life-threatening malnutrition. They are in dire need of assistance and medical treatment.
Hodeidah has a very high malnutrition burden for several reasons. The main reason is the aggression that has besieged the governorate and its coast, preventing fishermen from going to the sea and obtaining adequate food. Another reason is the rising unemployment. Here is the 3-year-old Saba struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit.
The 3-year-old Saba is struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit. The United Nations warned weeks ago that at least 98,000 Yemeni children were suffering from malnutrition at record high rates. However, despite the ongoing collapse of the health system in Yemen, there has yet been no international response.
There has been a noticeable increase in the number of malnutrition cases in the past 2 months. They exceed the hospital's capacity, where we only have 12 beds. We had to receive patients in other departments, such as the emergency department, and this affects the health of children and increases the number of deaths.
The health sector in Yemen has suffered a continuous deterioration amid the Saudi-led war in the country. Saudi-led coalitions of blockade has prevented the arrival of food and medicine to millions of Yemeni children and women. The Saudi-led coalition is not only targeting the Yemeni children with airstrikes, but also violates their most basic rights, such as access to food and medicine, in a clear breach of the international humanitarian law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Al-Hudaydah.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
An unrepentant Donald Trump on Tuesday, 12th of January, denied inciting an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol in an attempt to shift blame that Democrats rejected as despicable as a number of senior Republicans began publicly turning against their president. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith, Joanne Grieve, Tom McCarthy, and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Growing Cohort of Republicans Turn Against Trump as He Denies Inciting Capitol Attack. Unrepentant President Donald Trump on Tuesday, 12th of January, denied inciting an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol in an attempt to shift the blame that Democrats rejected as despicable, as a number of senior Republicans began publicly turning against their own president. The president spoke to reporters on the South Lawn of the White House for the first time since a pro-Trump mob rampaged through the Capitol last week, leaving five people dead. Democrats accuse him of stoking violence, and a vote to impeach him went ahead on Wednesday. So if you read my speech, people thought that what I said was totally appropriate, Donald Trump insisted as he headed to Texas to tour parts of the barrier he ordered constructed on the U.S.-Mexico border as part of his hardline immigration policies. The president then sought to draw a false equivalence with last summer's mostly peaceful protests against racial injustice in America. He said, if you look at what other people have said, politicians at a high level, about the riots during the summer, the horrible riots in Portland and Seattle, in various other places, that was a real problem, what they said. Last Wednesday, 6th of January, Donald Trump gave an incendiary speech to a raucous crowd near the White House, insisting his election defeat by Joe Biden could be overturned, and urging the crowd to march to the Capitol and fight much harder against bad people. He said, you'll never take back our country with weakness. You'll have to show strength. Democrats have directly linked the speech and previous Donald Trump comments to the carnage that unfolded when rioters, some carrying Confederate flags, fought with police and looted congressional offices on Wednesday, 6th of January. House Democrats have led demands for Donald Trump to be removed or face a historic second impeachment. Meanwhile, a handful of senior Republicans in recent days have joined calls for Donald Trump to go. And crucially, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, indicated to associates that he believes Donald Trump deserves to be impeached, according to a report by the New York Times on Tuesday. With Mitch McConnell thinking it will make it easier for the party to purge him as a liability. The New York Times further reported that the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has toyed variously with asking Trump to resign, supporting impeachment, and considering a vote to censure the president. And the senior House Republican Liz Cheney said she would vote to impeach Donald Trump. The president of the United States summoned this mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of this attack. Everything that follows was his doing. None of this would have happened without the president, Liz Cheney insisted. I will vote to impeach the president. As he left the White House on Tuesday, 12th of January, Donald Trump said, "The impeachment is really a continuation of the greatest witch hunt in the history of politics. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. This impeachment is causing tremendous anger, and it's really a terrible thing that they're doing." Democrats gave short shrift to Donald Trump's denial of responsibility. Speaking to reporters in New York, Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, said, "What Trump did today, blaming others for what he caused, is a pathological technique used by the worst of dictators. Trump causes the anger, he causes the divisiveness, he foments the violence and blames others for it. That is despicable. The technique Trump is using is used by the worst dictators the globe has ever seen. Donald Trump should not hold office one day longer, and what we saw in his statements today is proof positive of that," Chuck Schumer said. Federal investigators are warning of additional potential security threats around the inauguration of Joe Biden next week. NBC News reported that extremists are using Telegram, an encrypted communication app, to urge violence and even share knowledge of how to make guns and bombs. Multiple media outlets also confirmed an ABC News report that the FBI expect armed pro-Trump protesters in all 50 state capitals and Washington before Inauguration Day. Trump's potential to fuel further unrest is a source of anxiety. Behind the scenes, Donald Trump has reportedly continued his retreat into paranoia and unreality, repeating in a conversation with the House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy the lie that so-called Antifa left-wing activists, not his supporters, were responsible for death and destruction inside the Capitol building. "It's not Antifa," Kevin McCarthy reportedly replied. "It's MAGA. I know, I was there." MAGA refers to the Trump slogan, "Make America Great Again." The House voted on Tuesday night, 12th of January, on a resolution seeking the use of the 25th Amendment, which provides for the removal of a president deemed unfit for office, although it has never been used. Dependent on the Vice President Mike Pence, the gambit failed because of Pence's refusal to cooperate. After days of silence between the pair, Donald Trump and Mike Pence held a good conversation at the White House on Monday, 11th of January. The conversation on Monday evening was, according to an unnamed official telling the Reuters news agency. Some who responded to Donald Trump's call to storm the Capitol building, prompting clashes in which a police officer was killed, a rioter was shot dead, and three others died, were caught on video chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," after he withstood demands for the president that he engineer overturning the election result, which is not in his power. The House of Representatives vote to impeach Donald Trump on one article for incitement of insurrection occurred on Wednesday. The timetable for an ensuing Senate trial is uncertain. Unlike Trump's first impeachment in December of 2019, a sizable number of Republicans in the House and a handful of Senate Republicans have signaled support for impeachment. Those lawmakers included Liz Cheney, the third-ranking House Republican. Republicans expect up to 20 GOP lawmakers to vote for impeachment, according to a report by Punchbowl. Meanwhile, Ted Lieu, a Democratic congressman, told MSNBC Network, "We don't actually need a lot of evidence here because it's all out in the open. There is no dispute that Donald Trump gave a speech. There is no dispute there was an attack on the Capitol building. And there is no dispute that multiple people died." Last week's huge security failure is under growing scrutiny. The Washington Post said it had obtained an internal FBI document from the day before the attack, warning extremists were preparing to commit violence and war. The report undermined previous claims that the FBI had no intelligence about an imminent attack. The FBI and the Department of Justice on Tuesday held the first press conference by any part of the U.S. federal government since the Capitol attack. Michael Shervin, federal prosecutor for the District of Columbia, indicated that many amid the hundreds of pro-Trump rioters who violently invaded the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday, 6th of January, are suspected in a mind-blowing range of crimes, including felony, murder and sedition, and conspiracy. Neither the Department of Justice nor the FBI has explained how the security failures came about at the Capitol building, but Michael Shervin said rioters were being pursued across the country. The range of criminal conduct was unmatched, Shervin said, and warned lawbreakers, "You will be charged and you will be found." The former federal cybersecurity chief Chris Krebs, who Donald Trump fired for saying the election was secure, told CNN, "This is the equivalent of ignoring the pain in your chest for a couple of weeks, and then all of a sudden you have a catastrophic heart attack. We are on the verge of what I fear to be a pretty significant breakdown in democracy and civil society in the United States."
Debate. Iran is the new home base of Al-Qaeda. That is the new allegation that the lame duck and outgoing U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has made against Iran. This coming from a former FBI director who said, "We lie, we cheat, we stole while at the FBI." What does he hope to achieve by making these baseless allegations against Iran? In this edition of the debate, we will look at why this so-called maximum pressure policy of the U.S. has failed miserably under Pompeo and the U.S. President Donald Trump, as exemplified by the failed foreign policies of this outgoing administration. Joining us to discuss this further are our guest Jonathan Fryer, who's an author and broadcaster, who joins us from London, and we also have Brian Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Brian Becker. Let me first start with you. The allegation, Iran has become a new, quote, home base for Al-Qaeda, surpassing Afghanistan or Pakistan. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it's laughable if it wasn't a serious problem that the Secretary of State of the United States, the former CIA director, is actually making up lies in the last days of the Trump administration. Again, it's part of the caricaturing, demonizing of Iran by the U.S. government. That wing of the U.S. ruling establishment that is following Pompeo, they are trying to find other reasons that could be used against Biden should he dare try to go back to Obama's earlier position of engagement with Iran vis-a-vis the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Again, Iran has been an opponent of Al-Qaeda, while the United States has in fact been supporting the Al-Qaeda brand, certainly in Syria, and to a large extent inside of Libya when the U.S. Bombed along with Britain and France under the aegis of NATO, the Libyan government, such that it could finally destroy the Gaddafi government. And of course, we know the chaos that ensued. And in Syria, in Idlib province, the Al Qaeda forces, Al Nusra Front, have had virtual control for some time. They are, even in the words of Hillary Clinton, our allies. So the irony here can't be lost. I mean, Iran is a fierce opponent of Al-Qaeda and has been Iran offered to work with the United States after the September 11, 2001 attacks, an offer that the United States rejected. Meanwhile, the United States has been willing to use al-Qaeda as foot soldiers in places where the U.S. has targeted governments for regime change. So, again, the irony of ironies. But this is a fabrication, this is a lie, and it's also designed to create enough hostility and animus against Iran prior to Donald Trump's exit that would make it more complicated for Biden to resume détente or rapprochement or a normalization or a re-entrance into the JCPOA.
Well, let's expand a little bit more about what Pompeo has said, Jonathan Fryer. I'm going to quote him. I would say that Iran is indeed the new Afghanistan as the key geographic hub for al-Qaeda, but it's actually worse. Unlike in Afghanistan when al-Qaeda was hiding in the mountains, al-Qaeda today is operating under the hard shell of the Iranian regime, as he calls it, protection.
Well, this obviously is complete nonsense to liken the situation to that in Afghanistan, where, remember, Osama bin Laden and his devoted troops were based, is absolute nonsense. And clearly it is a fabrication. Mike Pompeo produced no firm evidence whatsoever to justify his claim, and in fact refused to take any questions at the event where he made these allegations. And I agree with Brian, absolutely, his last point. These have been made, these allegations, as an attempt to really make it as difficult as possible for Joe Biden and his incoming team to reestablish anywhere near like normal relations with Iran after the 20th of January. I mean, I hope that Iran will treat these allegations with the contempt that they deserve and not see it as a provocative move. After all, this is a, in a sense, a toothless tiger. Mike Pompeo and his boss, Donald Trump, are very much in the last days of their administration. It is interesting that Mike Pompeo was meant to come to Europe this week, but the European Commission of the European Union and the Germans said quite firmly, we don't want to see you, so he hasn't come. He's stayed behind in Washington, and it's just making mischief on the sidelines.
Well, I mean, one of the things that the Iranian Foreign Minister, Brian Becker, has said that should be recalled, first of all, he said is Pompeo is pathetically ending his disastrous career with more war-mongering lies, and then he says no one is fooled, noting that hijackers from the September 11, 2001 attacks came from, as he said, Pompeo's favorite countries rather than Iran. 15 of the 19 assailants were Saudis.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, when you think about the whole sort of narrative that Pompeo is providing, it's such a fantasy. But you know, Pompeo is speaking to a limited crowd and with a very narrow agenda. He's doing a couple of things here. As your other guest said, and as I was also affirming, it's trying to throw more obstacles in the path of the Biden administration to overcome, or using Republican allies in Congress after January 20th, if Biden indeed wants to re-enter into a good faith negotiations with Iran, which, again, we're uncertain about. But it's designed for that purpose. It's also designed to keep Pompeo sort of in the headlines, but not connected as much to Trump at the moment that the entire establishment finally, after a week of where we witnessed a fascist assault on the seat of government, deliberately designed to obstruct the peaceful transfer of power, which has been sort of a central theme about the durability and strength of the American form of governance, showing that it's exceptional, etc. Trump and his minions disrupted that. They broke that consensus position that's a requirement for ruling class politicians in America, launched a violent assault, and now Trump is being impeached today, probably. All of his the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all eight of them, yesterday issued an extraordinary statement to American forces saying, if you participate in seditious activity, you'll be criminally culpable. This follows on the 10 secretaries of defense, living secretaries of defense, who warned members of the armed forces, including the Department of Defense Secretary Miller, not to use the military to upset the U.S. election. When you think about all of that, and Pompeo's over there at the Department of State, he wants to have headlines about something else other than his association with what is now a very, very, very isolated regime here in Washington. So he's making headlines to say, hey, I'm over here fighting terrorism. He's talking to his evangelical religious base. Hey, I'm over here fighting against the Muslim terrorists, as he would put it. So he's also, the second part of his plan here is to create space for himself so he's not as identified with Trump. At the moment, Trump is identified with an attempted takedown of the U.S. government.
So do you believe that that is the case, Jonathan Fryer? In some sense, it does make sense that Pompeo is using this as a distraction. With the U.S. At a minimum being so focused on the proceedings that are happening on the House floor right now, moving forward with an impeachment against Trump. Is that something that seems plausible to you?
Yes, I think there's a strong basis of truth in that. I think that basically Pompeo wants to divert attention from what is going on in Washington. He also wants to rally Republicans towards his cause, if he can, by raising yet again the absurd monster of Iran as they see it. So that there are Republicans who have said that they will support the impeachment of Trump, and some who've said that they would even agree to Mike Pence, the vice president, intervening and actually taking Donald Trump down. So yes, by diverting attention in this way, Mike Pompeo is basically saying, don't worry about Trump, don't worry about what's going on in Washington. The real story is this confrontation with Iran. But this is a very tired narrative which has dominated all 4 years of the Trump presidency, and particularly since Mike Pompeo took over as Secretary of State. But it's not one that's going to go on forever, I don't believe. I think the time has come for a general rethink of the whole relationship between Washington and the Middle East and within the Middle East, because interesting things are happening there as well, with the reintegration of Qatar into the Arab community, and really a more realistic attitude towards Iran than has been the case for some time, at least from Washington's point of view.
One of the things that I wanted to get your idea on here, Brian Becker, is the fact that you mentioned how this could throw some kind of hurdle or challenge for the Biden administration in terms of it wanting to return, perhaps, to the Iran nuclear agreement, the JCPOA. We are looking at how al-Qaeda has been supported in Syria, whether it's al-Qaeda offshoot supported by Saudi Arabia and directly maybe by the U.S. in terms of weapons, arms, etc. Do you think that there's some kind of effect that this would have by making this type of statement or revelation, or in Pompeo's eyes, equating al-Qaeda with Syria in order to have the incoming administration look at Iran in a negative light when it comes to Syria?
Yes, I think the Biden foreign policy team, when you sort of see who it is, of course, Anthony Blinken, Jake Sullivan. Anthony Blinken will be Secretary of State. He was a senior foreign policy official during the Obama era. And Jake Sullivan, likewise. Lloyd Austin, who's from the Pentagon, literally a general, again, taking over the Department of Defense, which is, you know, according to the American system, it's the military is supposed to be under civilian control. The president is the commander-in-chief. Typically, the Secretary of Defense is a civilian, but more and more and more, everything as America militarizes, the generals are actually exercising operational control. They have to get a waiver first, but when you look at that team, they're not going to really be that influenced by Mike Pompeo's antics at the end of the Trump era. I mean, everybody knows that Trump is isolated. He's finished politically. Pompeo wants to run for president. He wants to be the Republican candidate in 2024. So he's kind of navigating now to be, he doesn't want to break from the Trump team because Trump is still so popular with the Republicans. So he's not resigning like so many other cabinet officials, Betsy DeVos or Elaine Cho. Other cabinet members have resigned in the last week. Pompeo doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to alienate the Republican base because he wants to run for president. And at the same time, he doesn't want to be tarred with everything associated right now with Trump. So what I think he's really doing more than anything, he's doing a couple things, but more than anything, he's cutting out space for himself so that when he revives his presidential aspirations in 2024, he's got arm's length from Trump by promoting other issues like hostility with Iran at the moment that Trump is isolated. And at the same time, not completely breaking with Trump because Trump still is very, very popular with the Republican base. So I think this, in large measure, is domestic politicking on the part of Pompeo, using Iran as a convenient punching bag.
Well, this coming, again, Pompeo's statements and allegations against Iran, Jonathan Fryer, coming from a man who stated while he was at the FBI that we lie, we cheat, and we stole. You know, it's hard to take this man seriously with that being one of the things that he has said about actions at the FBI. Now, this maximum pressure policy by this administration has been very, very severe. But not to say that his predecessor, the U.S. President Barack Obama, did not exert that also. Do you think the Biden administration is going to follow that line? Or will the approach be different when it comes to Iran?
I think it's very interesting that not only Anthony Blinken, the prospective Secretary of State under Joe Biden, but others in the team are very experienced people who did indeed work under President Obama. I think they'll want to push aside the Trump years and the Pompeo time at the Secretary of State, push them on one side almost as if they didn't happen, and in a sense go back to the Obama era to a certain degree. That does mean that, of course, there will not be straight away a clear friend of Iran, but I think they will take a much more realistic point of view than has been the case with the Trump administration. And certainly there will be a willingness for proper talks, proper negotiations, and whereas I quite understand why the Islamic Republic didn't wish to enter into negotiations with Donald Trump in any form, I think the situation will be very different when Joe Biden and his team, if the team is indeed confirmed by Congress, that then he will have a much more realistic approach. But I don't think we should fool ourselves that it's going to be all sweetness and light from now on. There's going to be quite a tough time for negotiations, but I think the responsibility and the experience of those people coming in with Joe Biden at the head is an encouraging sign of moves to come.
Brian Becker, the U.S. has been accused in one form or another of being associated with al-Qaeda and with terrorists like the Daesh terrorists, whether covertly or indirectly or through its allies. There's nothing new about that. If you think that that is the case, do you think that this relationship is going to, if you agree that is, or disagree, of course, you can let us know, if this relationship is going to continue, whether it's, again, directly or through its allies, in wherever part of the world?
You mean the a relationship of sorts with al-Qaeda?
Exactly.
Well, you know, the U.S. considers all of the forces on the ground as very temporary allies when it makes alliances with them. Same with the Kurds in Iraq, or the Kurds elsewhere, or minority peoples. You know, the U.S. doesn't really have any commitment to any allies. It uses allies for its own ends. In the case of Syria, it didn't matter to the United States that the rebels, the so-called moderate rebels, were in fact dominated by people who chose the al-Qaeda brand. It didn't matter at all. The U.S. wanted to overthrow the government of Assad, and so they were using the human materiel that was available to do that. Similarly, they've done that in Afghanistan over the last, ever since 1979. Used to be friends with Osama bin Laden and all of the fighters against the Soviet Union, because the U.S. at that time was trying to overthrow that government in Afghanistan, which was allied with the Soviet Union. So what the U.S. does with allies like al-Qaeda in Syria, or al-Nusra, or however you want to, or however they want to brand themselves, it doesn't, you know, we just have to recognize this is a feature of American foreign policy. It's cynical, it's manipulative, and it's willing to use any entity for its own immediate short-term interests and then throw them away afterwards. It means they're complicit with the worst kind of criminals like al-Qaeda, and at the same time they can use a struggle against al-Qaeda or a struggle against ISIS as a pretext for the re-intervention of American military forces elsewhere. It's a very cynical, manipulative game.
And Jonathan Fryer, I can't help but recall the special investigative work that came out of AP Associated Press a couple years back that talked about how the Saudi-UAE coalition was cutting deal with al-Qaeda in Yemen, and the U.S. arms were ending up in al-Qaeda's hands, and there were even deals that were cut that not only had U.S. funds supporting al-Qaeda, but that these groups were fighting alongside al-Qaeda to battle the Ansarullah fighters. The U.S. completely aware of this. So then you have Pompeo it's saying Iran is aligned with al-Qaeda. So obviously you can see where I'm getting at with this question.
Yeah, I mean, it is at first sight, it is almost an ununderstandable situation how one can justify the American point of view. But absolutely agree with Brian that America doesn't have real allies or friends. It has interests, and it will act according to how it sees those interests and line up for or against different entities according to which those interests are. But what will be really fascinating to see over the coming months is to what extent that the Biden administration will continue Trump's announced determination to withdraw as much as possible from the Middle East and run down the American presence, not only in Iraq, but in other countries as well. And I think that will be very interesting to follow indeed. But I don't think we should be ever surprised by who the Americans get into bed with if, quite frankly, at that time they see it as being in their interest and not necessarily in the interest of the countries concerned.
Thank you for that. Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster from London. And Brian Becker, thank you, from the Answer Coalition from Washington, D.C. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
ببینی پیش خدا چه موقعیتی داری به حرف این اون گوش نکن مردم برای
If we want to find our true position in the eyes of Allah, we must only consider him in our actions and do not be very much happy with the sayings and admirations of others. The titles and respect given by people to each has no value in comparison to the honor and glory that Allah gives. These are all temporary credits which are not necessarily in harmony with realities. Now, the search for truth is very important. If we search for truth inside our heart and find the real position of Allah in it, then we can claim to be the real man of action and the true lover of Allah. The true lover of Allah is not merely happy with the claps and cheers of this and that. People themselves are better aware of their hearts and their wrongdoings. They know that Allah does not disclose their secrets to others. This is why we as Muslims must look again in our hearts and find the true place of Allah in it. If we do this, we can find whether we are with Allah or without Him in our lives.